Hi, this is Steve. For many people, visiting with an attorney is not a pleasant idea. As a matter of fact, it's probably on par with a dental appointment for root canal work. Expensive and painful. And with the advent of online do-it-yourself legal services, some folks opt for the do-it-yourself option, thinking they'll be able to save what they believe to be an exorbitant attorney fee. And for some simple legal transactions, that might suffice. But when it comes to matters of greater importance, however, much larger costs may be incurred by not getting it right the first time. A good attorney specializing in disability law can keep you from making costly mistakes and may save you far more money than the fee they charge. When it comes to creating housing options for a member of your family with developmental or intellectual disabilities, it is wise to deal with an experienced attorney. I have known attorney Dan Blau since we first moved to West Michigan 14 years ago. He is the go-to expert on disability law and estate planning. I spoke with Dan several months ago before COVID-19 rocked our world with social distancing and face masks. The topic of our discussion was creative housing for people living with disabilities. For your convenience, we are posting the PowerPoint that Dan uses on our Facebook and our website. We'll also provide Dan's website and contact information should you wish to contact him. Now let's move on to our conversation with Dan Blau. We're with Dan Blau now and talking about alternate forms of housing for people with disabilities. Dan, did you want to start out with basics there?
Sure. Thanks for inviting me again. This is great.
You're welcome.
I've been working on housing for people with disabilities for quite a few years now, back since I was the director of the ARC here in Kent County. And I worked with another nonprofit called Hope Network that does housing development for people with disabilities. And what we found is that people don't just want to pick the group home down the street or some group home that they're not very familiar with, as our whole concept of self-determination really gets embedded in our practices. People want to create their own housing options and one that really fits their needs and their family's needs. So there's a lot of interest in this topic of creative housing for people with disabilities, but it's not for the faint of heart because it requires you to kind of know a lot about the funding streams for both the brick and mortar and the support services. I guess the three main points I would say near the beginning of this are that there is more variety now and people can be more directly involved in setting up the housing options they really want, especially through consumer control and self-determination. But you have to understand the support services. That's point number two. And the support services are much harder to put together than the brick and mortar. You have to understand how public benefits work in terms of your SSI and SSDI and especially Medicaid. You have to understand how private funds could be in the picture to augment the government benefits to get what you want. And so understanding support is the real challenge of this whole topic. And it's really easier to arrange for brick and mortar than it is to pay for staff support. I get a lot of calls from families to say, hey, I'd love to set my son Ben up in a house. There's a great little house that's one block away from mom and dad, and they would love to see it get set up while mom and dad are still alive and kicking. And they get all entranced with the idea of having that particular house. And a lot of times a parent could buy a house, or they could help arrange for the son with disabilities to buy a house there. But you can't just jump into the brick and mortar without knowing how the support services are going to work. So that requires you then to go kind of legal on this to figure out what are the structures. And this is my last introductory point, is it will sometimes take technical assistance and legal assistance on how to hold this property and how to arrange for the support and how will the funds from a trust fit in with the other public sector funds? It's not really easy to do, but it sure is satisfying when you can make it work. So that's kind of where I'm going this afternoon is, how can we give people more options? How can we fund the support services? How can we pick brick and mortar and maybe even have some new resources for the development of brick and mortar that the system may not have considered before? And then what kinds of legal advice do you need to get to put this all together? So it's putting the pieces together that we're talking about. So back to the issue of the first fork in the road is really, Do you want to create something that's like licensed foster care? In Michigan, they call it adult foster care, even if it's run by mom and pop or if it's run by the mental health system. There's a lot of different kinds of adult foster care under Michigan licensure laws. And so you have to understand, sometimes mom and pop foster care can be really a good option for some people. They know that there's this 6 or 10 persons that have lived in this foster care setting for a lot of years, and it's being run well, and it's being run by Mr. and Mrs. Jones, and they're experts in putting together foster care. But then what if Mr. and Mrs. Jones decide to close up shop and move to Florida? Or what if one of them has a heart attack? Some of the proprietary foster care is not as stable as you would hope. There's other kinds of foster care that are directly connected to the community mental health system, where they fund the creation of what they call specialized residential settings for people that have pretty high needs. And they have a lot of rules on how to run that and how to staff it and how to create menus that are up to snuff with the licensure and how to post menus and all that kind of stuff. Becomes quite institutional in a lot of ways. And that's not really where some of the families are. They want to have a house there where the support is proper, but the rules are tailored to what they need, not a one-size-fit-all set of rules, like having to put the menu on the side of the refrigerator at a certain date about what they're going to serve and all that stuff. More consumer control. So what's really happening is there's a lot of families out there that want to create housing, that want to either hook up with an existing nonprofit agency or create a new nonprofit agency or just do it within their family. And those are options that are well trodden now or well created across the state. So let's move a little bit. How can you hold real estate if a family especially wants to be at the center of creating supportive living for their own son or daughter and not just wait for the next slot of housing and specialized residential? And there's really 4 ways to kind of hold the real estate. One is ownership by the person with a disability. They can own their own home, and it doesn't count against them when they figure out if they're below the $2,000 asset limit for SSI or Medicaid. So there can be a home ownership option, but there's some pros and cons to that. We'll talk about that. Then there's ownership by the family, where they just, like my example that I started out with, where they know there's a house down the street and they want to own the house as a family and let their own son with disabilities live there with a couple of his buddies. That's an option. There's acquisition and handing over the house to a special needs trust that might have been created for the person with a disability. And that has some pros and cons and a lot of pros to it. And then there's development by nonprofit organizations. How can a nonprofit be in the picture to help create this apartment or this housing or this condo?
What you're talking about is not unique to the state of Michigan. Many of these things are going to be the same no matter where you live. There could be some differences in points of the law, but for the most part, a lot of this is going to be able to transfer over to almost any state.
That's true. And there's great examples around the country of creating housing in regular stock of houses and apartments in the community. The Washtenaw Intentional Communities and the people in Evanston, Illinois, and others are Madison, Wisconsin, I think, is a real innovative setting for doing a lot of creative housing. So it's all over the country, but this is what I've learned a little bit in Michigan. So the first option that I just mentioned was direct ownership by the person with a disability. And the pros for that, of course, is the pride of ownership by the person with a disability and their family, more direct consumer control over that brick and mortar, deciding who's going to be the housemate if they want a housemate, and a great way to encourage personal growth by the person with a disability. But the downside of that direct ownership is it's true that it's an exempt homestead while they own it and it's their principal residence. But what if it's not working out and they need to sell it and they own it and now the proceeds are $100,000 of equity stuck in their pocket? Now they're too rich to get Medicaid and they have to put it into some other exempt resource, including maybe a special needs trust, a self-funded special needs trust. But that can be more complicated. There's some property tax advantages of having Well, not a there's not a property tax advantage of being a direct ownership by yourself. You still pay regular property taxes. But those are pros and cons. And I've worked on examples of somebody who had active parents who wanted to buy a house on Fuller Avenue, and they did, and they got a person from their church to live in the house with him, and he invited a couple of his best buddies to live there with him, and he had the mortgage. There was a little bit of underwriting by the nonprofit that I worked for on putting it together, but he owned it, and actually he paid off his mortgage about 2 years ago. And then, unfortunately, he recently passed away, but he had a house of his own, and he was very proud about it.
You had mentioned that if one of the cons of ownership is if they sell the house and there's a large gain. But obviously, if they sell a house and buy a condo and reinvest that money, it doesn't affect the benefits.
You just have to make sure that the proceeds go into something else that's exempt, like another homestead that's your principal residence, or
a really expensive car.
theoretically, yes. You can own one car and still be on Medicaid. So what about this next option of family ownership? I've got some examples of having done that, where the family actually just purchased a freestanding condo. It's part of a condo project, but it's like a freestanding house. And they wanted the pros of the family determining who would live there with her daughter. The family could actually have the benefit of the growth and equity of the house over time. And they can participate in setting the house rules that they would like to set for their daughter. But the downside is the family is actually the landlord then. And not every family is adept at being a landlord. And some families are running out of gas. They're tired. They've been, even though they've had their son or daughter living with them for 40 years, they're not sure if they want to stay that active in being the landlord for their daughter and their other friends that might live there. And so there's some downside to family ownership, but it's a balancing act. The biggest goal is permanency after they're gone. And what if, you know, mom and dad have a stroke and they can't do that landlord function and none of the other kids or family members seem able to do it or want to do it? It can start to fall apart if it's just family owned. So that may not have quite as much permanency and security as some of the other options. That kind of brings us to this hybrid approach of having a special needs trust owning a house. You can create a trust, and just as a review, a trust is a legal document where you title property in the name of the trust, either bank accounts or real estate or any kind of property in a lot of cases. And once it's held by the special needs trust with the rules set out in the trust and under trust law, then what's in the right kind of trust does not count against them when they figure out if they're eligible for Medicaid, so that's good. And if the house is owned by the trust, it's not a countable asset that even if they move out and it loses a homestead status or cannot be considered a homestead, the trust still owns it and they can sell it when it's time and buy another house. The trust can buy another house for the benefit of that same son or daughter. So the pros of having a trust own real estate are that the trust ownership has some of the benefits of a direct family ownership in a lot of ways because the family set up the trust. But it has and this is key, a trust has a firmer succession plan for what will happen when mom and dad get sick or pass away. And it can have a succession of trustees that you know they're in place. They've agreed to do it in advance, even if it's a corporate trustee, and they will carry it on past the life of the parents. So that has a sense of permanency that's a little stronger beyond the life of any given individual. The downside of having a trust own it is it might increase the property taxes, trust ownership. A lot of times the property taxes will be higher. Won't be subject to some of the special tax advantages of having direct home ownership. And it can be difficult finding a successor trustee, somebody who will take over when the parents can't. So you have to think that through carefully, and that's what attorneys and other housing specialists will help a family do. The last option that I'm going to mention, and this is one that has a lot of interest by a lot of families, is, well, you know, we're not rich and we don't have a lot of money to put together this house and to put together this service funding package. But what if we were a nonprofit corporation? where we could get gifts from the community and from foundations and from others that be tax-deductible gifts to a nonprofit. Would that help us get the money we need to put this up? And in a lot of cases, it will. And when you're a nonprofit organization to create supportive housing, it doesn't mean you have to create licensed adult foster care. And you can be a nonprofit that creates supportive living and in unlicensed settings, regular houses and apartments and condos. And so nonprofits are key in a lot of cases. The other big advantage of a nonprofit housing corporation is it has an inside track of getting certain funds from the government to put up the house. You know, HUD, Housing and Urban Development, passes out a lot of dollars to create affordable rental units for people with disabilities who are low income. And to understand all those rules of how housing grants work from the government is a little daunting, but it's not insurmountable. I always say that a good housing specialist is got to be bilingual. They have to be able to speak HUD, and they have to be able to speak community mental health, CMH. And those two worlds don't know each other very well. But if a nonprofit organization can apply for government benefits that are for affordable housing for people with disabilities, they can get some big chunks of money. And that's what I did when I worked with Hope Network, as we applied for HUD and MISHTA and Housing Trust Fund and low-income housing tax credits and all these fancy ways of raising capital to put up a nice place. And then the mental health system takes up from there and figures out how can we put our Medicaid dollars toward the support staffing in that affordable place that has been created, and so that people can afford to live in a decent place without having to have ongoing huge gifts from family and friends for the long haul. They can still use private money in the mix, but it helps when the housing is free and clear. So we've created examples here in my presentation of four houses side by side that were all set up to serve people with disabilities, and three in each house. Rule of thumb when you create new housing from scratch is have as many bathrooms as you have bedrooms. That sounds silly. You can save a lot on support staffing costs if people have their own private space rather than it's always shared. And, of course, foster care is almost always shared space, both in bedrooms and in bathrooms. But if you create housing intentionally with that little rule of thumb, you can sometimes avoid some support staff costs.
It might cost more for the extra plumbing at the onset. In the long run, it's going to be less expensive.
And for the staffing support, that's our experience. So we've created, 300 or 400 units of housing over a few years all around Michigan on how to put together the HUD and other MISHTA, Michigan State Housing Development Authority money, to create affordable rental units for people with disabilities. So there's examples here. We've got all kinds of examples where nonprofits are in the picture. That a lot of times if the state housing authority is giving you a grant to put up brick and mortar, they'll want to make sure that that project is not commingled or intermixed with other projects that could go bad. So they like you to have a new little nonprofit for each project that they help fund. And so we created probably 30 little nonprofits that would hold brick and mortar and develop rental housing under the rules of those grants that we got. Another source of the grants is the Federal Home Loan Bank that gives grants for the development of affordable rental housing.
Something similar can be developed in other states. They might have their own MISHTA, but it might be the Wyoming version of it.
That's right. So Illinois has got its own housing development authority, and most states do. So, and it's all really comes from the federal government, passed down through HUD grants. There's a lot of fancy name programs for how they do disability-related housing development. The ones that you see most often are just HUD grants, HUD 811 programs. 811 is just the section of the law that created this funding stream, and everybody knows them as HUD 811 programs. There's some creative housing that's done by Shelter Plus Support. They call it Shelter Plus. They recognize that there's a need for a development of rental housing that's affordable for people that are on SSI or just above the SSI level, which isn't very much to live on. You need subsidized rents in a housing. And so the HUD piece that you can weave in there, if you can speak HUD and apply for HUD grants, really makes it affordable, because then you only pay one third of your SSI. SSI this year is something like $783 a month. You only pay one third of that as your rent for room and utilities if you live in a HUD-backed place like that. There's other rental schemes and different kinds of programs, but they're all exciting in terms of being able to make it affordable to live in a decent place. And then the private money can be used to augment Medicaid, if possible, to create the kind of support staffing structure that you really want. There's examples of how we've put together condo projects and, you know, group rental projects in order to make it affordable using government-backed and gifted money if you're a nonprofit that's tax-deductible by the donor. So I know that's a lot to throw at people in terms of how to put it together, but I would just say that don't get too excited about the brick-and-mortar location first. Figure out what you really need and start working the person-centered planning process through the mental health system. Sometimes they call it person-centered planning. Sometimes they call it self-determination or individual service budgets or CLS, community living supports. Figure out what's going to be available for the staffing support that you need, and then get excited about how to either create a new place that might even be more family controlled, like through a trust, or have a connection to a nonprofit that is developing a bunch of housing for people with disabilities, and how can you get involved with them? Or I guess the last alternative is, how can you maybe be at the forefront of creating a new nonprofit organization that can do the application for some of these grants and gifts? And if you're leaning toward creating a new nonprofit, in other words, you like the idea of having family control and being at the center of this, really consumer driven by what you need, but you don't want to necessarily just jump on to another nonprofit housing development organization, then there's a little bit of legal work to do. And I think there's a real need for attorneys like us and others who can help put together the corporate structures for the nonprofit organization, or help with the special needs trust if you choose to actually own the property in a special needs trust, or just give you advice about how your government benefits are going to be affected by all this. There's a need for technical assistance, and it's just not there so much for so many families. My big push in so many years, and I'm not very successful yet in this, is how can we get localized clearinghouse organizations to really track who's doing what? You know, who's doing licensed foster care? Who's doing, as a nonprofit, the development of affordable rental housing for people with cognitive impairments or autism or Down syndrome? What families have gone out and really, really worked hard to create something that's family driven to get what they really want in that house that's down the street? Would they be willing to share information with other people? Everybody seems to be starting from scratch. And Steve, you and I have talked about this for many years. We're not very far on creating that kind of clearinghouse, but we need it. And before I retire, we're going to get it somehow.
Yeah. I'll help.
Yeah. So it's a big topic. It's an exciting topic. There's a lot of good success stories. I would say, as a cautionary measure at the end here, that it's not like you create this housing and you wind it up like a clock and it just ticks until it's done and then you don't need it anymore. You do have to tweak these housing arrangements over time. You get a mix of two or three people that are great, and then the mix changes and it's not great, and you got to figure out how to enforce rules and how to do blended management. One of the key things for this concept of supportive housing is, or key organizations, is this thing called the Corporation for Supportive Housing. It's a national effort to do supportive living in regular houses that are affordable. And they have the concept that I think is very simple, but very true. Usually the things that are true are the simplest. You have to have blended management of the landlord function and the support service function. If somebody is decompensating and not able to fill the rules or follow the rules to live there in a safe way, then you don't just kick them out because, and that's what foster cares used to do, is kick people out that couldn't fit the rules. You accommodate them. You do blended management. You figure out what will help them fulfill their obligation to protect the rights of quiet enjoyment of the other people that are next door. And so you really have to go with the flow and bend over time as to how you create this. And there needs to be somebody that a family especially can rely on to make that work over time. You know, there is a misnomer out there that people think, well, the higher need you are, the more disabled you are, the more you need to be in foster care. And that's not really true. There's some people who have very high needs who don't do well in a six-bed group home and will never do well in a six-bed group home because of their behaviors. So you may look at somebody that's got high behavioral needs and needs almost one-on-one staffing all the time, but they can do much better in a smaller setting or a one-person setting sometimes. Now, there's a challenge for how to really meet somebody's high needs in a one-person home money-wise. But there's ways of blending that together to make it work better than a six-pack group home. So don't presume that high-need people have to be in foster care and that it's only the high-functioning people that can go into supportive living in unlicensed settings.
Absolutely. Appropriately supported. I like that term because it could be a very high level of support or a very low level of support or something in the middle. Mm-hmm. But for the individual, the appropriate level of support can in many, many cases allow them to live far more independently than in a group home.
Yep.
But for some folks, a group home might be the best solution. Dan, I thank you. If there's anything else you want to add in here, I do have one more question. Somebody's hearing this in an area where there's not a lot of support. They maybe live in a rural environment and they want to take a look at some kind of creative housing for their son or daughter. What is the best way for them to get started in terms of attorneys? It's like doctors. You know, you don't want to go for a heart problem to a podiatrist. Attorneys do specialize. If mm-hmm. if they're in Grand Rapids, they want to talk to you. But let's say they're in another state.
Yeah, it is hard when you're sitting up in the center of the Upper Peninsula of Michigan with very few people around that have similar needs. And how do you really put this together? You really need to reach out to, I would say, one of the government-backed resources that people often miss is organizations that are funded by the federal government, as in DD councils, developmental disability councils, and the like. They're funded really by federal legislation.
And every state has one.
Every state has one. And the same grant source that funds DD councils also funds things that are called protection and advocacy organizations, usually in the state capital of the state. But they have satellite offices around many states where you can call them and say, I mean, they're the closest thing to a clearinghouse that we have. I would say it's not perfect, but they at least can put you in touch with organizations that already are trying to do what you think you need and help you brainstorm on putting it together. It doesn't mean they're going to put together all the housing themselves, but they give out grants to organizations to do this. We'd love to have a grant in Michigan from the DD Council to do this clearinghouse function, to set up a website where people can look in their state at who's doing what. Hopefully one of these years they'll fund that.
We'll keep trying.
Yep.
The other thing is that most states, if not all of them, have an ARC.
Yep.
Area Resource Center. And most of them have something called the CIL for Center for Independent Living, but they have different names for them. Mm-hmm. Like in Kent County here in Michigan, it's
Disability Advocates of Kent County.
Right, yeah. DAC is yep. the acronym they use for that. And along the Lakeshore, we have a Disability Network Lakeshore, but they are both CILs. And you, if you look up a Center for Independent Living for the state that you live in, you'll probably find that. And many of them might be able to give you very valuable information as how to get started or get in touch with other people that have a similar interest that you might not even know they exist in the next town. Yep. So there's always going to be a solution. Some will be easier than others, but they're all worthwhile pursuing.
Yep. Thanks, Steve.
Hey, thank you, Dan. Appreciate it. And we'll be visiting again on other issues.
I This is the Enlocky Chat Cafe portion of the episode, and all I need to say in regards to this chat with Dan Blau is it might have been a short episode, but wow.
A little bit of information.
Lots of information. Sometimes it seems overwhelming, but, you know, sometimes it's like, okay, I've got options. So let's grab your coffee or whatever beverage based on the time of day mm-hmm. and your driving abilities, and let's have some chats about this. Okay. Steve, what are your high points?
There was a lot packed into the episode when Dan was talking about HUD and MISHTA and... But the good news is that means there is a lot of aid and opportunity. And so when you talk to somebody who does speak HUD and speaks community mental health or CMH, you might find there's plenty of possibilities that didn't exist before. And you don't have to know about all of them. All you have to do is find the best one and pursue that. So right. Trying to be an expert on all things, you know, HUD and MISHTA and everything else is daunting.
And, you know, sometimes people get stuck in a specific pattern, right?
Yes, absolutely. Well, what happens is, you know, and I, just from our own experience, first thing I thought about is, well, I don't want him in a group home because I'm afraid he'll be stifled because Liam will become part of, well, he'll become a wallflower. And he doesn't really, unless he's challenged, he will kind of go at the easiest course. And a lot of people will do that. And I want him challenged. Okay. So I'm thinking there's a lot that he can do on his own if he's given the opportunity. If somebody else does it for him, he never will. So, okay, well, just check off. We don't want a group home. Then we don't want this kind and we don't want that kind. And we're not really trying to match up what he needs with what is best for his life, what he desires for his life. Mm-hmm. Nobody, when we got to be of an age to move out of our parents' house, came along and chose something for us without us having input into it. And I think even though in our case, you know, Liam is not very verbal, we can still impute what some of his interests are and whether he likes what we're talking about for an alternative place to live. It shouldn't be just based upon what we think is best as parents. I know some parents have said, well, I can't see any paying any rent. I want to have home ownership so he builds equity. But that might not give the right location for the individual's desires if they
or supports.
Or supports, yeah. I mean, there's more than one thing to consider. It's not just location.
No,
like Dan said, if you fall in love with the brick and mortar down the street and you want to buy that house because it looks good and it's a great deal,
right by mom and dad.
Yeah, but it might not be in a transportation route where your child can take the bus or get picked up. It might not be close to activities. It might not have a lot of things.
The other piece is this. Okay, as a parent, I'm a little bit older than Liam. Pretty sure he's going to outlive me at this point.
Right.
So that down the street from me now might be really nice, but he's not going to be down the street from other siblings or the other supports that we're going to put in place that will catch him when we're gone.
Right.
So, things to think about. And as a parent, because we are overwhelmed with all the other things that are always going on, we may not think about all of these things, which again goes back to getting the, and I loved how Dan said the technical support.
Yes.
To somebody to be able to say to you, that's a really good idea. Did you think about this? I didn't, but now I shall. And that is the value of that technical support. Not only will they speak the language, but they will ask you questions that I don't even know that I need to answer yet.
And you find those attorneys, if you're living outside of this area where Dan Blau is the, I think, hands-down expert.
Yeah.
If you're looking for someone, the best thing to do is contact Protection and Advocacy. Now in Michigan, they call that Michigan Disability Rights.
Okay.
They just changed the name of it, but every state has an organization like that. They know all the people that are working on housing throughout your state. So you could say, you know, call them up and say, we're looking for a really good attorney who knows the technical jargon for putting together some kind of housing option. And they'll say, well, just call this one or two or three people that have the expertise for that.
Because
you're not going to find it looking online necessarily.
No. No.
You want to find it by people that understand what they're doing. There's also an organization called the Coalition for Community Choice. Their website provides search capacities, so you can enter whether you want to live alone or you want to have a roommate, where you'd prefer to live, how you'd prefer to live, the level of support needed, and the type of disability, and it can make suggestions for different areas of the country where that type of housing is available.
Initiatives. Options.
Yeah, right. And you can give them a call. That's how we found that Heritage Farm or something in Illinois that
yes,
they don't have any openings for the next 50 years, but that's the problem with some of them. But, you know, they all will talk to you and they all share ideas. This is a great group of people that share ideas on how to make something work.
Right. And we just have to keep connecting these things together. You know, like Dan said, there's not a central clearinghouse, but as we continue to draw these things together, we're going to get there. We're going to get that clearinghouse because we're going to start broadcasting that information.
I think it basically, don't get overwhelmed. Think first of all. Well, yeah.
Get overwhelmed and then calm down. Don't eat the whole elephant. Just take one bite.
It's a matter of what is the most important thing. And the most important thing that most people have told me, parents, over the years is, I want my son or daughter to have friends. I want them to have a meaningful life to them, to do things that they enjoy. I want them to be safe. I want them to experience life like anybody else.
Right.
They have to be able to take some risks and maybe fail and learn, but always have that safety net of family support or friendship support. Well, thank you very much. You want to take us out or you want me to take us out?
I will do that honors. Thank you so much for listening to us. I hope you found this most informative. I hope that worked for you as well. I want to thank our producer, Alexander Johnson, for his time in reining us in and keeping us on track. Our daughter, Holly Johnson, for the graphics and the design of our website and all the things behind the scenes that she does. Thanks to our intern, Daniela Munoz, for her behind the scenes gathering of information and output of information. And
she's our reach person, and research all of
our
person.
Research and our she also touches base with the people that we've already done interviews with and makes sure that everything is ready in a little packet, and she just keeps us all together so nicely. Thank you, Daniela. And our listeners, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
If you need us to delve into something a little bit more, send us a note, check us out on Facebook. Let us know.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.